You're listening to the Heroes Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome back to Red Shirts and Runabouts. We're part of the Heroes Podcast Network. We are your weekly or bi-weekly Star Trek podcast. We discuss all things from episodes to the new shows coming up, comic books, games, and such. I'm one of your regular hosts, Greg Bosco, and with me as always is the very fine Captain Derek. Say hello, buddy.
Hey, Greg. Good to be back. And you're not too bad yourself, you know?
I think I'm the tolerable one. I think you're the effective one. It's a good balancing factor we have.
Well, you definitely have better hair than I do.
Well, I mean, I did cut all of it off. So it's slowly coming back now, but it's good to be back. We're this week we're still continuing our prepping for Picard series because the Picard show is rapidly coming upon us. It's not that far away in the future, is it?
Less than a month. I can't believe it.
And even today there's some more news about kind of like a Picard prequel being released a little bit.
Well, there's comic books. There's basically it's a countdown kind of style comic book like they did for some of the movies, the Kelvin timeline movies, and it's supposed to be very good. I have not gotten over to my local store to pick that up yet. I'm a solid 2 years behind on comic books right now. So, but it's supposed to be very good. There's also several novels that are coming out that are prequels or midquels, I guess, to take place between Nemesis and the Picard series. So those are all things that are out and coming out soon that you could read as extra material.
Well, and let's be real. We've talked about this before. It's kind of hard to keep up with comics unless you are absolutely dedicated to doing so.
Well, and there's just a lot of really good ones for Star Trek right now. You know, aside from the ongoing stuff, there's been a lot of really cool Mirror Universe stories. Voyager even got some Mirror Universe stuff, which is something that I'm really excited to read. Because Voyager never got any Mirror Universe episodes. Neither did TNG, right? But it got yesterday's Enterprise, which is a little close. And then, but DS9, Enterprise, they got Mirror Universe stuff. Of course, Discovery did as well. So, I'm looking forward to reading some of that stuff. But yeah, we have less than a month, and we have to finish up today. We're finishing up our season 6 episodes. This is part 2 of season 6 of TNG. And then next week, we will do our season 7, which is Gambit, parts 1 and 2, and then All Good Things, the finale of TNG.
We've got a lot of good episodes this week and next week, so I'm pretty pumped to talk about anything about season 6 and 7 Next Generation is always high on my list.
Yeah, there's some really good stuff in there. I mean, a lot of episodes that just didn't make the cut. You know, I picked 20 episodes for prepping for Picard in my top 20 quintessential Picard episode article out on heroespodcast.com. And a lot of them are two-parters, so I took the top 20 thing very loosely. And I still couldn't get everything on the list, you know, just couldn't do it.
Are we going to find a way to squeeze Sub Rosa into this?
Oh, jeez. No.
I know.
We'll have to do a prepping for Beverly series at some point.
Oof. Anyways, let's not talk about a depressing topic right now. Let's continue with the four episodes today we're going to be talking about. Tapestry, Lessons, Starship Mine, and The Chase. And The Chase is my favorite of these four. I mean, it's close with Tapestry.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, we will definitely get to that. The interesting thing, I didn't even realize this really when I put the list together, but Starship Mine, Lessons, and The Chase are actually back-to-back episodes.
Yeah, it's cool. It's unique because Picard was so heavily featured in those three.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so Tapestry is the first one chronologically on our list. It's season 6, episode 15, which aired in mid-February of 1993. Tapestry, I guess to kind of kick things off, is one of my absolute favorite episodes of Star Trek, not just TNG. And so I've always really loved this one quite a bit. And I'm not sure really where to start. Maybe just a quick summary of it is this episode is kind of Which Christmas movie is it? It's A Wonderful Life, I believe, right? It's Picard wishing he had done things differently and what his life would have been, right? So the episode kicks off with him basically dying on the operating table from an injury, and Q showing him, giving him an opportunity to change an event from his life. When Picard was younger, as hard as it may be to believe, he was a bit rowdy and cocky and got into a fight with a few Nausicaans and was stabbed through the heart and now has an artificial heart. And Q's giving him a chance to avoid that confrontation, because if he had a normal heart, then this weapon would not have disrupted his artificial one, causing him to die. Greg, what are your thoughts on this one?
I mean, Tapestry, even though the chase wins out by like 0.1% to me, Tapestry is an amazing episode with beautiful performances by, you know, Q, Picard, the supporting cast and characters. And it's fun because everybody, the way the episode is tailored with wanting to go back and make changes, everybody's had those thoughts. You know, it's one of the most common questions in interviews or even psychological examinations. If you could go tell your 15, 20-year-old self something, what would you tell them? And that's what this episode's about. And it's amazing how one little event changing one thing can have ripple effects down the entire line for Picard's life. And that's what this episode discusses, is he ends up becoming the man that he doesn't like, even though he thought he might.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great way of putting it all together. And this episode's always hit home for me big time, because, you know, I tell people I'm very good at making a lot of mistakes. I just don't repeat them. I just learn how to make new ones. And so, you know, there's a lot of things I look back on, like, for example, being academically dismissed from my college after my freshman year. I wonder what things would have been like if I had taken that year seriously and, you know, gone to class. You know, so stay in school, kids. But, you know, what would be different in my life? Would I, you know, be with my wife? Would I be in this house? Would I have my job and, you know, my dog and all those types of things? How would it be different? And this episode shows that you never know. It's kind of a butterfly effect kind of situation. But we have Q, of course, to play around with the rules of time a bit and ensure to Picard that he is the only one who will be impacted. Everybody else is going to be just fine. You know, the Enterprise will be fine. The Federation will be fine. It's just him that will be displaced. And that, of course, there's some real life reasons for that, so you can actually have the cast involved in this episode. But I really like seeing the effects of the change, you know, which comes later in the episode. So I don't want to skip too far ahead, but what did you think of his early days in the Academy with his friends, you know, Marta and Corey?
Well, I liked it because it felt real. And the other part about this that I love so much is this Picard with his time in the Academy, where he's a little brazen, a little arrogant, pretty outgoing with the ladies. I mean, he's like another version of Riker almost at this point. But if you also, the other thing I love about this episode is it brings a lot of Star Trek Nemesis into question with the way they had like young Picard shown in that movie compared to, I mean, only in the one image, but of course he's bald in the picture in the movie. And then in the young Picard in this has hair, and the way he interacts with people and the way he's direct and blunt. And it's just, he still has those tendencies even when he's older, but he's more mature about how he processes them. But even an older, more mature Picard can still be pretty direct and brazen when he wants. He just tempers it very well. And you can see that with the young Picard and the way he interacts with his friends and such.
And I think it's an important distinction, one that even Picard has to learn in this episode, that just because he did reckless things in his youth that he may be embarrassed about now, doesn't mean he still doesn't take reckless action when his more experienced, mature self sees fit. I mean, times that he's risked his life or risked the Enterprise to save other people, to do ethically what he thought was right, you know, and those things could still be seen as reckless or risky things, but he's doing it now with experience behind him, and he's doing it now to help others, right? To do the moral, ethical thing rather than picking fights with Nausicaans. I like this part of the episode a lot too. I do think it's kind of, it's a little telegraphed, the whole kind of love interest with Marta. And kind of the way that goes down is not particularly surprising, you know, knowing of course that, you know, she's going to end up on her own ship, different from him and all those types of things. But I liked the idea that she always had some kind of interest in him, but he was too immature, right? And now that he brings back with him this experience and this maturity, that now she sees the kind of guy he could be, you know, that then she actually has legitimate interest in him.
Yeah, and like you said, though, even the whole concept of Picard basically picking a fight with three Nausicaans, which is not, like, you know, a fight that most people would want. I mean, that says a lot about young Picard, and the whole end result is the fight and him getting stabbed, and how the way it plays out with the rest of the episode. And, you know, we could spend 4 hours talking about this episode alone, but the genesis of what's happening is Picard evaluating his past decisions, and when he changes the past, you know, after Q assures him that, yeah, like you said, it won't impact anybody else, when Picard chooses to change the past and stop the fight from happening, he realizes moving forward he doesn't like the end result of what he is. What, he ends up working in, like, astrophysics or something like that?
Yeah. He's now, okay, his rank is a little confusing in this episode because they say that he's an ensign at one point, but then they call him a lieutenant at another point. Like, Riker calls him a lieutenant, but he's an ensign junior grade when we're first introduced to him. But either way, the point is supposed to be that he hasn't really gotten very far in his career because, and this is the key, is that he took chances, he took risks. And while maybe they weren't always the best decision, that character trait of taking risks, of pushing forward with things, allowed him to move up in the ranks and eventually take command of the Stargazer, which led to the Enterprise. And so when you cut ahead to this future and seeing him in the blue uniform, like, that was a very limited action figure, and I really want that action figure. If anybody out there has one, we can talk. But you know, the idea that event in his life was a turning point for him, I think, is significant. It was a near-death experience, and that near-death experience got him an artificial heart and showed him his toughness, what he could endure, what he could go through, and that taking a risk wasn't going to end everything, that he could still move forward from that. And that's what he does. So when he avoids that whole experience, he begins to play it too safe. You know, you look at all the captains that we know, and the only play it safe captain that comes to mind is the captain of the Grissom in Star Trek III.
And it didn't go well for him, did it?
Right? Like, we make fun of him, like, the whole time, you know? We're going to do it all by the book, you know? And none of our captains that, you know, lead our shows are by the book captains. None of them are. Some might be a little more loose with regulations than others, but they will all break the rules when they think it's the right thing to do. And that's who Picard is, right? When you see Picard in Insurrection, for example, later on down the road, when he stands up to the Sona to save the Baku, you know, that is not what the Ensign Picard would do. That's what our Captain Picard would do.
Yeah, and that's probably my one major gripe with this episode, is when it shows the future and it's like 30 years of him being an ensign/lieutenant, it's almost dejecting to think that Picard would just stay 20 to 30 years in Starfleet doing mind-numbing jobs. Maybe they're important, but for 30 years as an ensign or a lieutenant, I mean, at this point, he's already beat Harry Kim for longest to get promoted.
Well, I think there's a couple different ways this can be taken too, because it depends what type of person you are. these are all jobs that have to be done. They're needed jobs. They're important jobs, or they wouldn't be there, right? This job would not exist on the Federation flagship if it wasn't required. But some people are happy in those jobs. Some people like doing those jobs. They enjoy those tasks for whatever reason. And in our world, it's a work-life balance, or it's an interest in the material, or whatever it is. But that's not who Picard is. Everybody's different. So if you're out there and that's the kind of job that you love, then you made the right decisions for you. Picard isn't that type of person, though. Picard is, you know, the diplomat of diplomats commanding the flagship of the Federation. And that's not the average person. And I think it's an important distinction to make.
Yeah, because the average person doesn't become captain of the Enterprise.
Right. And I think that's important, right? As much as I would like to be the captain of the Enterprise, I think I'm probably closer to the average person than I am to Picard.
As I mean, you can argue
that might make me.
Yeah, you can argue that for the 5 minutes he's on screen in Generations, Captain John Harriman of the Enterprise B is a very average captain. But Rachel Garrett of the Enterprise C in yesterday's Enterprise is anything but average. She's obviously a fierce, strong leader and a warrior.
Absolutely. Now, there's some fun stuff in this episode I don't want to overlook either, because while this episode is clearly very important to defining the character and the personality of Picard, there's Q. And the Q-Picard relationship is one of my favorite things in Star Trek. And we get a lot of Q in this episode, and a lot of one-on-one time with him and Picard. You know, there's the iconic scene of the two of them in bed together the night after Picard supposedly sleeps with Marta. You know, he wakes up next to Q, and it's just a wonderful scene. You know, you've got Q delivering the flowers a little bit earlier on to interrupt the two of them, and he's the bartender for a bit. The dynamic is really wonderful, and I think this episode's interactions between Q and Picard helps set up the finale for the show.
Oh, absolutely. And it reinforces the whole concept that Q has had a greater interest in Picard and humans. He's been saying it the whole time, but this episode really kind of proves it.
Yeah, I mean, Q's not just going around doing this for anybody. He's doing it for Jean-Luc because he likes Jean-Luc. He's intrigued by him. He finds him fascinating and interesting and compelling. And that's why he's willing to do these things, because maybe Q knows. Maybe Q knows that the events in All Good Things are going to occur and Picard has to be the one to stop it. And he needs Picard to be Picard, to not regret who he is and regret the decisions that he's made. Because if Tapestry does anything at all, it cements to Picard who he is.
That's absolutely correct. And even the way the episode ends with him and Riker talking and reminiscing, and, you know, Riker suggesting he would love to have met that Picard and the one that would fight the Nausicaans, and that leads to another story of that Picard had and dealing with Nausicaans again. And it just, the episode with him and the relationship with Q and the relationship with the rest of the Enterprise staff or officers, excuse me, it's just, it's a beautiful Picard episode.
Well, and I think that this also informs the chase that we'll get to at the end of our talk today. And that's his back and forth about whether or not he should have been an archaeologist. And some of the things he says when he knows to turn down his professor, I think stem from this episode, which is only a few episodes before this, that there's this cementing of who he is, and the decisions that he's made in his life have led him to exactly where he wants to be.
And that's a good transition point to kind of move forward for the next episode on our list. Because we could spend a lot of time talking about Tapestry, but Lessons, which is an episode.
I think Starship Mine is next. I might have
Starship
to
Mine.
You out of order.
No, Starship Mine is next. I said the wrong one when I was reading my notes. But Starship Mine is another reminder of when Picard takes actions, he doesn't go at it half-assed. He is all in.
Yes. I like to call Starship Mine the Die Hard of Star Trek.
It is Die Hard of Star Trek, without a doubt.
And it's another time where Tim Russ shows up as not Tuvok, which is fun. But so this one, I put this one on the list simply because it shows his action side. Star Trek First Contact gets a lot of flack, as does Insurrection following it, for being kind of making Picard an action hero. But he kind of starts that off here in Starship Mine, don't you think?
He does, but it's also, you know, I know people kind of complain about the action stuff in Star Trek, but at the same time, Picard has seen some shit in his career, and he's been in battles, and he's been in fights, and he's been in combat. It's not that unheard of for a Starfleet officer, even a captain, to be involved in fights. Yeah, I mean, Nemesis, he's kind of fighting a monster, so that's one thing. While Riker's fighting a monster. But Picard's been in combat many times. This isn't, like, new.
That's fair. That's definitely fair. So this episode sees the Enterprise is getting cleaned, essentially, from these beta waves that they pick up during warp travel. And it's a slow scan that goes across the ship. It takes a couple of hours, it seems. And everyone's supposed to be off the ship because it kills organic life. And while the crew is supposed to be off the ship, a group of, I guess, mercenaries, because they're not terrorists. They're going to sell stuff to would-be terrorists, I assume. These mercenaries are trying to steal trilithium, which is a waste byproduct of dilithium, from the Enterprise. And Picard ends up stuck on board when he goes back to get his horse riding saddle.
If only Picard would have an actual horse saddle, a real one, just in his quarters at any given time.
I love it, though, because it really informs Generations when the two, you know, Picard and Kirk are both riding together, because they could ride, you know, and it was just funny. I always liked that. But so this episode's a very, very Picard-centric episode. The rest of the crew is essentially down on the planet at the lamest reception I've ever seen.
So lame that everybody's purposely trying to avoid the host. And apparently he's got the horrible reputation of just nonstop small talk.
Well,
which is like, probably why he got assigned to this outpost in the first place.
Oh, man, you're probably right. And then, like, when Data's trying to kind of, like, riff off of that, and Riker puts the two of them together, it is the funniest freaking thing, man. It's because it would never end, because Data's not going to get tired of it.
Yeah, he's not going to get tired of it, and the commander's going to just keep enjoying it, because he doesn't get a chance to talk to a lot of people. So he's going to, you know, Commander Hutchinson, he's just going to enjoy it as much as he can.
I will say, I feel like it was kind of shitty to kill him.
I was surprised. I remember watching it. I was surprised as hell that they killed him.
It just seemed kind of unnecessary because he shot with the same kind of weapon that Geordi shot with, supposedly at about the same range. They're both kind of shot in the chest. And Hutchinson dies, and it just seems like it doesn't have any emotional weight to it because we don't really know him, and his death is off screen. But at the same time, it's kind of crappy because he's this new guy. He's a nice guy. He's well-meaning, but he's just kind of lonely. And they just kind of kill him off very unceremoniously.
Well, yeah, especially when they've made the first part of the episode just entirely about making fun of him.
Exactly. You know, so that just kind of seemed kind of crappy. I felt like maybe they could have done something to write him into being a cooler character a bit. I don't know. But anyway, focusing on Picard. So Picard is trapped on the Enterprise. The main computer is down. He can't use phasers. They quickly kind of explain away why you can't use energy weapons because of the beta waves. And he has to, like, he goes into Worf's quarters and breaks out a crossbow, I guess a Klingon crossbow, and makes exploding arrows.
Yeah, so this episode is half Die Hard, a little bit of Rambo thrown in.
Seriously, and it's just, It's just really great that he's got like this cool crossbow, and then he's got the little welding gun that they kind of use as a weapon, which he threatens Tim Russ with. I'm drawing a blank on Tim Russ's Devore, and you know, it's just kind of cool to see this kind of like guerrilla tactics that Picard has to come up with while, you know, he's on a 24th century starship, you know.
I mean, but nobody knows that ship probably as good as him. I mean, you could argue Data and LaForge do, of course. But if you're going to fight somebody who can know the ship and knows where to hide and what to do, Picard would be a pretty devastating enemy.
Oh, I agree. But when he does get caught, I do really like that he claims he's Mott the Barber. Because Mott is a barber on the Enterprise. He's a Bolian. And it's a really funny little like throwaway line that's a great reference to a real character that we very rarely get to see. But they just kind of accept it. They're like, okay, Barber, like, would you have believed him?
Probably, like, realistically, no. So the last person on the ship is the Barber. I mean, maybe kind of, but I don't know. But it's funny because they kind of have access to the computer systems. They kind of don't, because you think, you know, a 30-second Google search on the Enterprise-D, they're like, wait a second, this guy's the captain.
Well, you'd think if they were stealing something as dangerous and coveted and illegal as Trilithium from the flagship, that they would at least know who the captain of the ship was.
I mean, if you go back to the original series, every alien, doesn't matter how big or how important or how unimportant, knew who Kirk was.
Right?
Every alien.
But, like, it's just, even if they didn't know he was the captain, to just believe that he's the Barber, I don't know. That seemed a little gullible for me, but, I mean, whatever, just roll with it. So they don't like, pat him down or anything, so he's still got the little welding gun that he uses on that Star Wars little data port.
Yep, the little data port.
Right? Like, where, that R2 would plug into. And he uses that to set off some kind of alarm system. I'm not entirely sure exactly how that worked, but it was clever, I guess.
It was definitely clever. It kind of asks the question of what exactly are those ports for, because we never ever see them in use ever again. It's the whole first contact scenario of, you know, when they're shooting for the little plasma ducts with the green plasma that can liquefy flesh, and you don't really think about it, but then you're like, why are those things even puncturable? Like, why is that a good idea?
Right? Like, the whole crew is organic. Like, what are you going to do? No, I'm totally with you.
You got Ensigns Meyer and Bosco on day one driving a forklift, and we crash into those things. You're like, oh, crap.
Oh, man. And, like, it's positioned in a really weird spot. Like, it's near the ground. It's only above the ground, like, 4 or 5 inches. You know, so perfect for someone who's sitting down, I guess, in the middle of engineering.
Yeah. For sitting down only, yep.
You know, and so, like, I don't know. I would buy if, like, that's what they hook up the modern vacuums to or whatever. Or it's, like, a power port or something. And so, like, maybe if it's a power port, he overloaded it with the welder, and that's what caused the alarm to go off.
Okay, I have a solution. Okay. That's where the modern Star Trek Roombas go to repower.
Right? Because, like, Ray made a good point. We were watching, it was one of these episodes. Oh, it was Lessons. And Beverly and Picard are eating, and then they, like, get up to go to the recital. And they just leave everything there, their food and everything. And Ray's like, so who's going to clean that up?
They've never really talked about that in Star Trek at all. Who's responsible for cleaning anything?
Right? And I was like, I mean, I guess they come back and get it, right? Like,
it's still there 5 hours later.
But anyway, so Picard, you know, he sets off the alarm, he blows up or damages the tank that's going to hold the Trilithium safe, and runs off. And then the mercenaries, of course, come up with a way to still move the Trilithium. And they're fighting their way through the ship, trying to get the 10 forward, because it's going to be the last place, you know, where this is touched. And so you keep seeing, it's a lot of focusing on Picard's logical thinking, his critical thinking, right? Of, you know, where would I go in this scenario, and what can I use without these technologies available? Kind of his resourcefulness. And it really leads into, you know, who he is in some of these movies. You know, the way he is in Insurrection is the same that he is in this episode.
Well, yeah, and one of the most common criticisms of Insurrection is it may not be a great Star Trek movie, but it makes for a good Star Trek episode. Mm-hmm. Because it does feel like an episode, and it's there's a lot of throwbacks from Picard to his actions in some of these episodes.
Absolutely. And, you know, Insurrection's got its own problems, of course, but what are you going to do? So they fight a little bit, and they finally get to 10 forward. And I love that he's, like, set up traps kind of like Predator style. right? And so he's got the lions on the carpet, and, you know, they're laced with gunpowder. I assume some super futuristic version of it. And he's able to take the little safety thing off the canister. Now, I get why he does that, because he would rather blow up the ship than let these mercenaries steal the trilithium. And I respect that. So my problem isn't with that. My problem is, how could it have survived transport?
Yeah, especially when they comment on how important that little stabilizer is.
Right? Like, if they're worried about walking it through a ship, you know, transport, so many things can't be transported because they're volatile. You know, it's happened on the show where they have to bring something over by shuttle because it's too volatile for the transporters. I would think trilithium would be on that list. But I guess for the sake of the story, they had to get it off the ship.
Yeah, which is something that Star Trek's had problems with for every series, is some of the times the plot needs a little bit of outside help.
Yeah, they kind of wrote themselves into a bit of a corner, it felt like. But, you know, but it's fun. And, you know, so they get off the ship. The beam is still coming, right? And Picard's, like, trying to talk to the planet. And meanwhile, everything going on down at the planet's been, you know, not particularly exciting. Riker gets knocked out, trying to cause a distraction because they can use Geordi's visor to emit a high-frequency audible sound that will render everybody but Data unconscious.
Yeah, and I don't even want to talk about that because it's still just contrived.
Yeah, they do a lot of things with Geordi's visor over the years. Like in Generations, you know, the Klingons, not the Klingons, but Sauron hacks it so that way they can, you know, spy on him and stuff and, like, whatever. But I don't know why something that's designed 100% for visual purposes would be able to emit a loud enough frequency that would impact the entire room.
Well, yeah, because they do so many things with Geordi's visor over the show and movies that at some point, I think there's even a comment that Data makes in an episode of, shouldn't everybody have a visor or implant eyes if they're so effective?
Well, yeah, that early on, they make a comment about why that isn't a requirement to, like, enhance officers. But yeah, so they do that. Everyone's unconscious. Data saves the day, and they get Picard. They stop the sweep before Picard gets, I guess, vaporized. At least like two people die, right? Tim Russ's character, I guess, gets enveloped by the sweep, and then the main mercenary, Kelsey, she shoots the other guy. I can't remember the other guy's name, but she shoots the other guy, right? Just kills him, which I thought was just, like, that's super cold-blooded. I don't know if, like, I wonder if that was the plan the entire time, was, like, to kill off most of the team.
To pull a Dark Knight and have, like, when the Joker kills all the people helping rob the bank, and that's kind of what happens here.
Yeah, exactly like that, right? Like, was that originally part of the plan, or did she start to do that because it went off the rails? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know, but... And apparently death by Baryon is not a good way to go. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Baryon. Sorry, I've been saying Beta. Baryon. Yeah, yeah.
Who knows? Star Trek linguistics.
No, you're right. It was the Baryon sweep. You're totally right. I just blanked on it. But yeah, so I don't know. Is there anything else you want to touch on for Starship Mine?
Well, the boxing into a corner with the trilithium is actually a good way of describing Lessons, which I think is a great episode. But the whole time the episode is happening, you can already tell that the plot is backed into a corner because of the connection Picard develops for another officer, shall we say?
No, I think you're absolutely right. So let's do this then. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, why don't you elaborate on that? Recently, on the Heroes Podcast Network, Echo Station.
Well, what's the main planet that Endor... The forest moon of Endor. It's a moon. So there's a major planet, obviously, that it...
Is the forest moon of Endor? Is Endor the actual planet, then?
See, isn't that confusing?
Yes.
Is it the forest moon of the planet Endor, or is it the forest moon called Endor?
Kaiju Curry House.
It got to the point where he started climbing the Empire State Building, and my mom is like, he's not gonna die, is he?
Oh no.
My mom doesn't know shit about these films, but anyways, it was just like, Mom, this doesn't end well for Kong. And she's just like, I can't watch the rest of this. Turn it off. I'm like, you can't get to this point in Peter Jackson's King Kong 2 hours and like whatever many minutes later and not watch the end.
Screen Heroes.
The nipples just were confusing to me because they just make no sense.
That is our clip, by the way.
But I mean, male nipples are kind of confusing anyway. So.
Right? Like, well, they serve true. Zero that's purpose. True.
Do you think that was the point he was trying to make?
It's a much deeper message, yes.
Is Batman and Robin a heavily an allegory? Social allegory?
Yeah.
Subscribe today at heroespodcast.com, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Spreaker, Podcast Addict, and more.
And we are back after that little break, so we could slide a promo in there. We're going to continue talking about our Prepping for Picard series. This time we're talking about the episode of Lessons, which is an episode lots of people don't seem to remember. But everybody remembers this is the episode where Picard essentially had a girlfriend. And mm-hmm. That was a big deal, because there's for years people were kind of, you know, were Picard and Crusher going to be a thing? And in this episode... He meets another senior officer on the ship, and I do like how the relationship develops very realistically, very organic. It's not fake.
No, it's very good, and, you know, because she's kind of a one-off character, right, Commander Darren, you know, you kind of have an idea of where things are going just from that the real-world perspective, but it's really believable. You know, she's strong and opinionated and direct and... You know, she's not like scared or intimidated by authority or anything like that. And Picard respects all of that. And then he finds out that she's a musician, very talented musician. And we learn that after the events of the Inner Light, he has continued to study music as well. And while it's very private, he's becoming incredibly knowledgeable about it. And this is something that they bond over. It's really pretty sweet.
Yeah, they bond over it because she also is very much into music as well. She has a certain passion to her about the stuff she loves, whether it's her career or her hobbies, that you can tell Picard is immediately attracted to, which I understand. I mean, confidence is a very attractive attribute to most people.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the fact that the two of them could bond over the music was kind of the main focus of the episode here. And it was kind of cool because you get to see an extension of the Inner Light of, you know, what he went through. It's shown that he doesn't really talk about that with other people. You know, I'm sure Deanna Troi knows, right, and everything, but and maybe Beverly knows, but he's very private about this, and he finally tells her everything, you know, that he went through, and it's difficult for him to do that. But he plays the flute. He breaks out the flute a couple of times, and they play that together. And it's really neat to see him bond over something like that. Because to your point about his love interests before this, you know, there was the will they won't they with Beverly, and then there was Vash, right? And kind of Marta, I guess, in Tapestry. And that's really all we know. You know, that's all we really get.
It's extremely limited from what we've seen in the past. And it's like you said, the will they, won't they with Beverly. It's by season 6, it's just become almost like a today it would be a meme. It would literally be a meme from the show of the two forbidden love that also act like they don't really care if they're in love.
Mm-hmm. It's a cool episode. You get to see Picard, like, genuinely happy a lot. He's smiling a lot. He's feels lighter in a lot of ways. And then, of course, that's contrasted by the end of the episode, where things get very intense and very real. But it's so rare that we get to see Picard happy with life.
During a horribly tense situation that they're kind of thrown into.
Well, because, like, the only other times we really get to see it, it's why I had Captain's Holiday on this list, because we never get to see Picard just enjoying himself. And it's almost like a curse where, like, if he's going to have a good time, it can't be that good of a time, right? It's we got to have something bad happen. So if he's not going to be taken hostage by a Ferengi, then this time we're going to create a natural disaster where the life of his newfound love is going to be jeopardized.
Yeah, and it's kind of scary because the episode today is even more topical with the firestorms, like the fire situation we're seeing in Australia, mm-hmm. where people are being displaced, lives are being lost and impacted. And this occurs right on the cusp, like you just said, of Picard finally letting his guard down with somebody and developing romantic feelings for someone, and immediately he has to send her into harm's way.
Yeah, and, I mean, you can kind of see this coming just because of her interactions in the episode. Yeah, she's working with Riker a lot. She speaks up a lot when she has an opinion about things or something she feels is relevant. She brings it up. And because of that, she ends up assigned to this mission to lead up this idea that she came up with, right, to create these force fields to help delay the firestorm so they can save as many of the colonists as possible. And it's a very smart idea, and it's a very brave thing to do. And when Picard tries to give her an out, even she knows that that's not the right thing to do. And that makes it even stronger, makes it even better that she has the same integrity that we expect out of Picard.
Yeah, she never wavers in her duty or her responsibility. And even when she's talking to Picard about the relationship as it's developing, she even in her own way kind of comments on, I guess, shall we say, Picard's inexperience in the romantic realms on how to build those relationships. But she does it in a way that's very, I thought, mature and appropriate, especially for the two people in that kind of position.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, there's some rockiness to it. Of course, there's the turbo lift moment, right, where the two of them they're having normal conversation and then another crew officer comes in. And he, like, completely changes, right? He turns forward. He starts addressing Nella as commander, you know, and it just becomes completely business. And it's very off-putting to her because, well, she thinks that there's something going on between the two of them. And she's right, you know, so she gets a little offended by that. And he has to kind of apologize, which is a big moment. I mean, how often do we see Picard apologize to anybody?
For a scenario like this, I think this is the only time, actually.
So there's just a lot of emotion to it, right? And then at the end, you kind of get the fake out death, which I'm not really a fan of that per se. Just simply because you cut to Picard in his quarters and he goes to the Reskin flute box and he closes the lid like, I'm never playing this again kind of thing. But, you know, and then it's just moments later where they're like, we found some survivors and we're beaming them aboard kind of thing. And, you know, it's the time frame's a little off. It's hard to know how much time passed between the firestorms hitting and then the survivors being found. We know it couldn't have been super short, right? It had to be some amount of time, but was it 20 minutes or was it 4 hours? You know, we don't really know. But of course, some people die, people we don't really know and never even get the names of, you know, for the most part, you know, but she does make it. So that's at least a little different. Like, Rey was, this is her first time watching this, and she was, like, straight up, like, oh, so they're going to kill her, you know? So how did you feel about that? Like, did you think it would have been, more narratively strong if they had her sacrifice her life, or do you like the way it ended?
Well, actually, the way you worded it originally about the fake-out, it reminded me of the criticism that you and I shared for Discovery, because Discovery did a lot of fake-out deaths. And we ended up discussing how we don't like it, because it takes away... It makes you believe that nobody's going to actually be harmed then. And it's the opposite of Game of Thrones, where Game of Thrones is so willy-nilly able to kill people that eventually the deaths stop mattering, because you kind of expect everyone to die. But when you start doing the fake-out, it does somewhat take away, because I, for a story point of view, I think if Commander Darren had passed away in the line of duty, I think that could have been used to even build up Picard's character even more about, like, another arc of the one time he lets his guard down and develop feelings for someone, you know, she dies. She's lost in the line of duty. And that's something you can build a lot of stories off of. Because now they're boxed into a corner where you know that she's alive, so but you know she's not staying on the ship. So it's like you could have either had a more dramatic ending with her loss, or this won't work. You're scared to put me into danger, so I just have to leave. Like that's yeah. I think that's a cop out almost.
I'm with you, and like he doesn't have another love interest to my memory until Insurrection. You know, which is a few years later. And so it's definitely conceivable that, you know, her death would have played into why he hasn't tried to engage in any other relationships. And maybe the near death is part of that, too. And that could be explained as well. And it's maybe just a product of it being, you know, a show of its time where it's more episodic than not. And while some things carry over, most things don't. But I'm with you. I think that it loses some of its weight, that she's just like, okay, well, I'm just going to go somewhere else then. You know, and that's, she's never brought up again. That's it. She's gone. And it's a bit of a bummer.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge bummer. And I think it was just a massive wasted opportunity to what they could have really done. They could have changed Picard's character. Not changed him, but kind of added another reason for why he does have to be distant, why captains, you know, it's been described in real life and on TV shows that the most senior officer is usually the most lonely.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it could have helped solidify his closed off privateness, right? Because, you know, Beverly mentions that when Nella's in sick bay, you know, that he's just a very private person. You know, and this would have helped solidify how private of a person he really is.
Yep, this is a good segue into the chase, because Picard is very private when it comes to emotions. But when it comes to his hobbies that are not related to, like, human emotions, like archaeology, the dude is kind of out of control with excitement. And it's fun. It's a fun watching him. And the chase is all about archaeological, you know, adventures. That's got a little bit of like an Indiana Jones kind of theme to it. And even, you know, we could joke about archaeology with space travel. I mean, you're talking millions of worlds to investigate. I mean, that's millions of worlds with billions of sites. That's a hell of an opportunity for an archaeologist.
Well, and what's great about this is it's one of the few threads that have really carried through the whole show, that he loves archaeology. This is a part of his character that has been throughout the entire series. And so it's not, you know, just randomly brought up and put back down, which I think is really great. And it brings together a lot of corners of the universe that you know, are so separated. Like in the real world, people joke about Star Trek aliens all look like us, right? Why are they all, like, you know, 2 feet and 2 arms and, you know, that kind of thing? This episode actually goes in and explains the why. And it's overlooked constantly. You know, of course, the real world explanation is that TV shows are expensive and making everybody a humanoid is just cheaper and more practical. But they have an in-universe explanation for why so many species evolved on separate worlds to look so similar. I love that.
No, I love it too, and you are 100% correct, and I couldn't say it any better. And the only thing I would add is, yeah, the other reason for a TV show to have aliens kind of resemble humans is so the audience watching can have a can relate to them and understand them and figure them out. You know, there's a game I played as a kid growing up called Star Control, and one of my favorite species is a species called Changesu, and they're literally living crystals, but they have no emotion and they don't really move, and they're super logical. Like, even they would make Vulcans look arrogant, but you can't relate to them because they're rocks. You know what I mean? You don't, you can't understand them. It's cool because it's a video game and a video game can do that. But when you're seeing aliens on screen, you want to be able to kind of, you know, relate to them and interact with them and understand them and kind of get an idea. So this show, this episode, makes it canon for why bipedal species are the dominant in the Milky Way galaxy. And I thought it was very clever.
Yeah, it's a really cool idea. It's a very neat concept. I like the way each species handles it. You know, like, the Klingons just, like, whatever, they don't really care. The Cardassians are insulted by it, that they could possibly be related to Klingons or whatever. But the Romulans, who are consistently portrayed to be highly intelligent, and, you know, that, like, when they do something, it's always very intellectually manipulative. Right? Their commander talks to Picard, and, you know, you can hear it that he wishes things could be different. That maybe if we aren't so different, that we could be something bigger together. And that's kind of the whole point of the episode. It's kind of the whole point of the Picard character, is the idea of species and people of different backgrounds working together to do something bigger than themselves.
Yeah, and it shows how, you know, even after meeting Professor Galen and Galen being killed, Picard takes his death very, very personally, obviously. But then he realizes that Galen was onto something huge. He quickly figures out that it has, you know, for Galen to be involved in this kind of galactic scale investigation, that it's more than just finding rocks, basically. And every planet they go to and they find something else, or they find the planet being destroyed, you know, the Klingons are involved, you've got Cardassians, you've got Romulans, all involved in this. It is a chase. It's basically a chase for the truth. And watching them interact with each other, and, you know, even the little quips between the Cardassians and the Klingons, you know, it's, oh, we're looking for a recipe for biscuits. And the Klingon, you know, is, if you want biscuits, you can have my mother's recipe. It's just watching the species interact. I loved it, especially that line from the Romulan at the end of, you know, when they find out the truth that one of the first species in the galaxy, which is what the chase is all about, one of the first species was, like, alone, essentially. And they knew that they were going to fade away, so they seeded a bunch of planets with basically amino acids and DNA. And they weren't trying to create life. They were just kind of trying to nudge it a certain direction. And the species looks bipedal. They're humanoid with two arms, two legs, facial features, nose, eyes, ears. And they actually very physically resemble, you know, changelings from DS9, because the actress is the lead changeling in DS9, which is
right,
fun.
How cool is that?
I loved it. I loved it. She's a great actress, too.
Yeah, that's such a fun little note. I thought that was really cool, because even Ray pointed it out. She goes, she looks just like one of the founders. It's like, hey.
She definitely is one of the founders later on. But it's fun, because the alien species is like, they didn't want to be alone. And they didn't know what was going to happen to them, but if they can nudge evolution along. And I do love the relationship between the Romulans, like you said, and the Federation at the end, when they're having, you know, the Klingons and Cardassians are sniping at each other, and what the Cardassians say, you know, to think a Cardassian could have anything in common with a Klingon, and she's, like, offended. She's upset.
It turns my stomach.
Yeah, it turns my stomach. And the Romulan, you know, it was just, I'm trying to find the exact quote because the quote was amazing. Especially fight watching, you know, by the way, we got to talk about how the Klingon tried to headbutt Data and it did not go well.
Yes. Are you talking about like at the end, like when they're, the Romulans are leaving?
Here's the quote. And when the Romulans talking to Picard, it would seem that we are not completely dissimilar after all in our hopes or in our fears. And Picard just kind of acknowledges. And then the Romulan says, then perhaps one day. I mean, it's a symbol, like you said, that even, and by season 6, season 7, they've already shown that there are certain Romulans that are not thrilled with the government. And they're not thrilled with constant vigilance of warfare. And now this one Romulan captain, who knows, maybe in the background lore he goes on to be one of those dissidents of some kind. And wants to have a more stable relationship with this, with their aliens out there. And I love that line because, you know, I'm a big naive believer that we're better off working together than against each other. And Picard is like that too.
There's so many interesting things about the Romulans that really shows that they didn't get their due time in Star Trek. Because they were always put on the outside of things. They were very rarely the direct confrontation. And you look at the movies, there's 13 Star Trek films. The Romulans are really only in one of them.
They're only in Nemesis, essentially.
Right? That's really the only one that they're in. And there's some arguments to be had about the one Romulan in Star Trek V, right? But you know what I'm talking about. And they're barely in the original series. They're barely in Voyager, which makes sense, but they're barely in Voyager. And they're barely in Enterprise because we haven't really, you know, interacted with we haven't had the Romulan War yet. And then in DS9, they're kept on the sidelines through most of the show and even most of the war. They're always there as kind of an afterthought. And it's a shame because this kind of interaction here shows just how complex they are. They're so less, they're less one-dimensional. So many Star Trek alien species are very one-dimensional. You know, you've got, you know, the Klingons are all about, you know, honor and battle, and the Cardassians are ruthless military, and the Vulcans are pure logic, right? And the Ferengi only care about profit. But the Romulans are so much more multifaceted that I think this point right here just hints at what that relationship could be.
And just because I know there's going to be a comment out there, when we're talking that the Romulans aren't involved in a lot of the movies, we're not talking 2009 Star Trek, okay? That the Kelvin universe doesn't count. It counts, but we're talking prime canon.
Nero, but the reason I don't really count that is because it's a rogue element outside of his time who's just hell-bent on revenge. Has nothing to do with the fact that he's really Romulan, right? It's not the Romulan government or the Romulan military.
We stand apart from the Empire.
Exactly. Right. So, like, even the movie tells you, well, it's not really Romulan. And so, like, even in Nemesis, it's barely that. Because who's running the whole thing? A human clone. You know, it's so rare that we actually got to go head-to-head with the Romulans.
Well, I would make a very unpopular argument that the Romulans as a species are the most similar to humans as a species when it comes to having multi-varied interests. They're not just military, and they're not just sneaky, and they're not just cultural or religious. They're a little bit of everything, and that's kind of what the Federation is. The Federation's a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I think of all the alien species, I think you're right. I think it's a kind of an interesting thing to think about and something this episode only really touches on briefly, but would have been cool to see more of. So one interesting note, and I was reading about this on Memory Alpha because I wasn't sure, but I guess, so Ronald D. Moore helped write this one. And fun fact, Jonathan Frakes directed it, which is great. But Ronald D. Moore is quoted saying that, and I'm paraphrasing here, that the alien could be one of the preservers, which are mentioned in the original series and in some of the books. And I like this idea because if you follow the path for the books, there's this whole Mirror Universe trilogy about how the preservers created two universes. And in one, they tinkered and helped kind of a leading hand. And in the other, they didn't. And what you ended up with is our universe was the former and the Mirror Universe was the latter. Right? It's an interesting idea. And Ronald D. Moore basically says that, like, the quote is, but this could be them and be internally consistent. The idea was that he wasn't making her a preserver, but he left it written in such a way where it's not that she couldn't be. And I think that's really cool.
Little side note, do you remember when all the clips for season 2 Discovery were out there and everybody was kind of suggesting, hey, maybe the Red Angel's a preserver?
Yes.
No. Yeah. Nope.
Yeah, some thought maybe it was an Iconian. I thought that would have been really cool to bring something like that in, to bring the preservers in and make the things that happened in those books, you know, more of a prime canon. I thought would have been cool. But, I mean, that's clearly not the route they took. So,
no, it is not. Well, I think we've kind of hammered these four episodes pretty good as we're continuing our prepping for Picard. But Derek, out of the four, what is your favorite?
My favorite is Tapestry, definitely. It's one of my top five TNG episodes across the board. So,
yeah, and the chase is for me because it includes a lot of historical type discussion that is just my other personal hobby. And so it beats Tapestry just a little bit. But again, it's almost for me, it's like comparing, what do you prefer, Best of Both Worlds or Yesterday's Enterprise? And I'm like, ah, I don't know, 99 for one, 98 for the other. So, all right. Well, this has been Derek and Greg for Red Shirts and Runabouts. We're part of the Heroes Podcast Network. You can find us, you can actually Google Red Shirts and Runabouts or Heroes Podcast. Or just go to heroespodcast.com. It's a good way to find all of our other shows, all of our other podcasts. Derek supports several of the podcasts, including Screen Heroes. We've got a new Star Wars podcast going on called Echo Station and a whole bunch more you can find there. But Derek, if somebody wants to reach out to you directly, how could they do so?
So you can find me at the Star Trek Dude on Twitter or Facebook. Please come talk with me about Star Trek or just movies in general, video games. I've been gaming quite a bit recently, took some time off. So come talk to me out there.
And you can find me on Twitter at @the_bittersteel. I've been enjoying a lot of gaming as well. I think our gaming style is a little different. I saw you've been playing a lot of Fallout 76. I just couldn't get into it. But
well, we can talk about that if you want.
That's a different podcast. But yeah, track us down on Twitter. And we've also got a Red Shirts and Runabouts Facebook group where we talk about the show, games, and it's a very friendly environment, very easygoing and low-key. So just search Red Shirts and Runabouts in Facebook groups, and you'll find the group, and you can request to join. But otherwise, we're going to be back in a week to finish up prepping for Picard. Then we're going to do an episode or two on the remaining short treks. And then the Picard show itself will come out, and you can better believe we're going to be talking about that.
You know it.
Until then, we'll talk to you all later.
Red Shirts and Runabouts is part of the Heroes Podcast Network and is hosted by Gregory Bosco and me, Derek Mayer. The music is by Flying Killer Robots. Please follow us at Red Shirts Pod on Twitter or at Heroes Podcasts on Facebook, Instagram, or heroespodcast.com. You can subscribe to our show on Apple iTunes, Google Play, Spreaker, and pretty much any other podcast app. If you enjoy the show, please support us. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/heroespodcasts, and we also have a Ko-fi, ko-fi.com/heroespodcasts. We'll catch you next time. Live long and prosper.